This is Next. I'm Morgan Springer. Rebecca Carroll's new memoir is called Surviving the White Gaze. In it, she describes her experiences as a Black child raised by adoptive white parents in rural New Hampshire. Rebecca is a cultural critic and host of the podcast Come Through, and she joins us now to talk about her book. Rebecca, welcome to Next.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's begin with your adoption story. Can you tell us how you came to be adopted by your parents?
Sure. My parents were young, white, liberal, idealistic art students who met at the museum school in Boston and married very young and started a family right away and had two biological children. My dad found a job in New Hampshire teaching high school art where he had two students who were transplants from Boston, a brother-sister team, and the sister became pregnant with her boyfriend back in Boston, who was a Black man, and she didn't really have a plan at 17, and my parents wanted to have another child and expand their family, and they suggested perhaps they could adopt her child, and that's the sort of, that's the short, quick and dirty version.
Yeah, so you're adopted, and you describe your childhood in the book as kind of initially idyllic, but then
Absolutely.
You started, you know, being a target of racism in the community that you were in. Are you comfortable sharing, like, that transition and what started happening or what you started noticing at a certain age?
Sure. So, you know, after that job and at that high school, in a different part of New Hampshire, my parents moved the family to another part of New Hampshire, an even smaller rural town where I was the only Black, became the first and only Black resident at, you know, 3 months old or something like that. And we lived in this beautiful farmhouse on top of a dirt hill road with acres of land behind us where my brother would camp. And we had gardens with fresh vegetables and a swing set and dinners outside. My mom was super attentive and super creative. And all of our friends wanted to come over. My brother's best friend referred to it, the Carroll's house where kids are king. It just was really an extraordinary experience. It was completely bucolic. It's why I open with that setting, because it essentially was the white gaze. It was the world that my parents created the way they wanted it to look without any indication of race beyond me. And there wasn't any real connective tissue. There wasn't any real conversation. It was all play and creative and art and love. And so when we moved to another house, sort of on the closer to town, and I started the first grade. And when we moved from that bucolic setting, my brother and sister were able to sort of take what resonated for them, the security of that bubble, into the world. But for me, I couldn't take that same security because it wouldn't protect me from what began pretty quickly to be a series of, you know, racist encounters and events. And I was sort of thrust into this world of being targeted and not understanding really why and how to navigate that. And so it started to feel really discombobulating.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you write about this moment where you and your friend are going out to recess and the teacher says something to the effect of, "You're pretty for a Black girl." And this other history teacher who made a suggestion about intelligence. And, like, in these just terrible moments, did anyone step up for you, defend you at those times?
So it's, I think, really important to note that my fifth grade teacher did say to me, "You're very pretty for a Black girl." That's what I understood and heard and was the racist comment from the outset. But what I internalized was worse than that, which is what she said afterwards, which is that most Black girls are ugly, are very unattractive. And she made this face as if she had, you know, smelled something rancid. That's what I internalized that did the most damage, that was most indicative of what the white gaze will do. And, you know, later, in high school, you know, it wasn't just the moment in class where my history teacher questioned my intelligence because I'm Black. He was also the father of a boy who was a friend of mine who forbid him to take me to the prom as friends because he told his son, my friend, that he wouldn't want to look back at pictures and see that he'd taken a Black girl. Like, that would be a real tragedy to look back and see that you wasted this important moment in your life by bringing a Black girl. And I think that in terms of, you know, stepping up, I don't think that any of my white peers had any sense of how to do that. I had a couple of friends who were sort of, who kind of came to the, right to the precipice, right to the, you know, to that moment of like, so what do you mean by that, you know, to the teacher, or, you know, and then the moment is gone and then it becomes irrelevant once again. And that's a choice that my white peers could make, but I could not, you know, like that, those kinds of incidents, you know, they didn't just happen. They bore into my psyche and into my sense of self and into, you know, the shaping of who I was, you know, and that, and these are just the incidents that I recall, right? You know, as I was vetting this book, I reached out to my sister to ask her if she remembered this one incident. I think it was actually the high school one where my boss called me the N-word. And I said, do you remember da-da-da-da? And she said, no, but I definitely remember when so-and-so threw you into the deep end of the water and called you the N-word and walked away. Like, this happened, like an actual racist hate crime happened when I was like 7 or 8 years old that I only remember as this sort of mean older girl offering to take me out into the water, into the, you know, to the deep water. Ooh, that's exciting because little girls are not supposed to go out there. And then arriving at the deep water and dropping me in the water to drown. But what I did not know is that after she dropped me to drown, I couldn't hear her because I was drowning, was that she then called me the N-word in front of everybody.
And it sounds like your parents, you were not having conversations about race and racism in the household, and your parents were not walking through these moments with you.
No, they definitely weren't. And, you know, I think that there was also the sense of I did not want to puncture this kind of bubble that they had created for all of us, right? Like that it would be somehow inconvenient, you know. I mean, that's again why I open with that chapter where my dad is like, look how lucky we are, look how beautiful this is. Like, he created this scape, that this landscape and this way of living that was beautiful, but it wasn't beautiful for me once I stepped outside of it and had to sort of navigate the way in which people were responding to me, the way in which racism works in America, which is the same for every Black person in this country. And, you know, it starts early, and then you have incident after incident. It's macro, it's micro, but it's always there.
You've mentioned the white gaze. Your memoir is called Surviving the White Gaze. For listeners who don't necessarily understand the concept, can you talk about what it is and what its impact is or can be?
The concept is not so much a concept, but a reality and a default in terms of how we decide what's valuable and what's not valuable, how we set the standard of beauty, how we set the standard of intelligence and intellect, the canon of literature, the canon of movies, the academic system, the across the board, every single structure that has a value system has been employed and defined by the white gaze.
New Hampshire, as you of course know, is a very white state. You mentioned that you were the only Black person in your town, and according to the census, about 93% of the state's population is white at this point.
At the current point?
Right now.
Yeah, okay.
Wow. Yeah, right now.
Wow, okay.
Is that surprising to you?
It's not surprising. It's just, it's like when I was writing the book, and, you know, my husband's a sociologist and sort of, you know, helped me with stats and looking back over, you know, kind of records of what the population and demographics were and so on and so forth. And when we discovered that it was like 99.9% white when I moved there, I was in fact the 1%. And it was like, it's just bizarre. It's just wild. And I, every time I hear a percentage like that of a place of an entire state, I think, what are you kidding? Like, what are you doing? what's happening? It's just so, it's just wild to me, especially now as a parent, where I just could never imagine raising my child in that kind of environment.
When you were 11, you met your birth mother, and over time you became almost inseparable from her. Not only did you spend time together, but you sought her approval and you put a lot of weight in what she said. But that slowly began to change when you were in college. Can you talk about what you began to realize?
What I began to realize when I had my first Black professor in college was that the way that she talked about race with me, particularly Black folks, was racist. You know, like I would not have understood, because I deferred to her on everything, the way that she sort of over-sexualized Black men, the way that she kind of co-opted Black vernacular, the way that she kind of looked at me and decided when or if I would be Black and under what terms I could be Black, because I was her daughter and she is white. And so there was no, I didn't have any agency whatsoever in how I understood or interpreted Black culture, much less my part of it, despite really yearning for that. So when I had my first Black professor, and he not only introduced me to all of these amazing Black writers and artists and history, but he also really contextualized the, you know, when I told him about some of the things that my birth mother had said to me, he was like, okay, that is racist.
Do you still have a relationship with your birth mother?
No, I do not.
And what about your parents and your adoptive family at this point?
My mom has been really wonderful and trying and struggling to get to a place where we can keep our relationship, because we love each other so much. But it's been very, very hard, because my dad has not been pleased with the book and or its reception. And, you know, she is his partner, and I understand that, and that is their dynamic. And but yeah, it's been a bit of a struggle. So it's sort of day to day. You know, I wrote the book to excavate the trauma and the memory and to present insight to my family, so that they would better understand who I was and what my experience was growing up in Warner and in their that family, and what it was like through my gaze. My hope, my best hope, was that my family would see this as an offering to evolve in their own thinking. I mistakenly believed that they would want to, because why wouldn't they? But so now that I realize and understand that they don't and won't, now I'm doing sort of like that work. Figuring out, you know, how to move forward with, you know, having had lost a couple of fundamental familial relationships as I knew them.
That was cultural critic and author Rebecca Carroll. Her memoir called Surviving the White Gaze came out this year. Listen to Next from the New England News Collaborative, wherever you get your podcasts.